afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And, yep, Bill Cundiff's not here. He is selling tractors down at the fairgrounds in the rain, alone. He just sent me a picture of the fairgrounds. It's like, oh.
He's lonesome Bill today.
It's just Bill and the tractors in the rain. So, anyway.
I hope he had a few more people yesterday.
He wasn't there yesterday.
Oh.
Wasn't his day to watch him, as they say. So
he drew the short straw.
Yeah, he drew teardown day. So he's at the home show at the fairgrounds. So if you need a tractor of some kind, Kubota, John Deere, scurry down to the Shasta County Fairgrounds and say hi to Bill.
And don't let the rain stop you.
Yeah, no. Well, it actually wasn't raining a minute ago, but, you know.
Today's your last chance.
But we have climate change, right? So it'll change. That's what it means to me. One day it's raining, one day it's not. So we have a fun show today. We have two guests, two totally different topics, two wildly different topics. The first topic is about the campus rape frenzy, which was kind of fun. I was really excited to see that come through. Stephen Manfredi from the Manfredi Strategy Group there in Alexandria, Virginia, took a liking to us a long time ago. I've never actually met him, but he sends us these great guests. And so we get to learn all sorts of new things that we wouldn't normally come across. And the second hour will be about a new book called DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington. So.
There are only five?
Yeah, it's only five. No, I was kind of excited about that, too. I'm like, five we can beat. Any more than that, we're buried. This is a co-authored book. You have two people. We have one of the authors on. We have Casey Johnson on. He is a professor of history at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate Center, where he specializes in recent U.S. political, diplomatic, and legal matters. He's the co-author of The Campus Rape Frenzy. He authored it with Stuart Taylor Jr. And, he's done a whole, I'm sure he'll tell us about those, written for The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York, Daily Times. And so, been a busy bee. Do we have him connected in there?
We do.
I just dialed the phone. That was like the extent of my expertise. So I'm not sure what happens after that. So
I am here. Thank you for having me.
That is super. You sound just like you did when I talked to you on the phone a minute ago.
This is always good.
I know. Isn't that nice when we can get from like one part to the next? Oh my gosh. So. Okay, so what made you guys, besides the fact we keep seeing it in the news, but the book is titled The Campus Rape Frenzy, and it came, when did it come out? I kind of forgot to look.
It came out earlier this year in January.
Nice. So why did you guys, have you written books together before?
We had. So Stuart and I, around a decade ago, co-authored a book on the Duke LaCrosse case, which was this famous false rape claim involving three lacrosse players at Duke who were charged with rape. The case was prosecuted by an incredibly corrupt local prosecutor named Mike Nifong, who was essentially using the case to mobilize the black vote, which he needed to win election in Durham, and in which he got the strong support of the Duke faculty and the Duke administration.
Lovely.
And much of the national media, especially the New York Times. And so, you know, we covered the case extensively and then wrote a book about it. It ultimately collapsed when the evidence of the guy's innocence came out. The prosecutor was disbarred. He went to jail. Duke never really apologized or anything, but nonetheless, it moved along. And so, you know, so we wrote about that. And one of the things that we assumed from that book is that people would learn that when we're dealing with these campus claims, you have to avoid rushing to judgment. You need to have due process. You need to have a fair approach to how it's investigated and how it's considered. And so we had been following this as a general issue. And then in 2011, but we assumed we were never going to be writing about this topic again. And
sure.
We both moved on to other things. And then in 2011, the Obama administration changed the rules. So they reinterpreted Title IX, which is, you know, federal law banning sex discrimination in educational institutions, to give to the federal government authority over campus sexual assault questions, and to say that there's an epidemic of sexual assault on campus. This was the administration's claim, and so colleges and universities needed to adopt new procedures that all increased the chances of being found an accused student being found guilty. So you have a felony offense, you know, sexual assault, that is being tried within the college.
And it's, and so the only police you get to deal with are the campus police?
Oftentimes not even that, and that's really one of the shocking aspects about this.
The whole
accuser's rights movement in the campus context does not want police involvement of any type. And so these cases are normally investigated by the Title IX office within colleges and universities. So these are bureaucrats who are hired generally for their particular views on gender-related questions. So they're presuming guilt from the start.
Where all women are victims and all men are abusers.
Yes. Well, yeah. the preferred word on campus is survivors, not victims. And, you know, so the argument is you make an accusation, you're automatically a survivor. Well, if you're a survivor, the allegation is over. So it's this quasi-judicial system that exists only when one college student accuses a student from her own school of sexual assault. It doesn't apply to other felonies. And then it goes through one of these Title IX tribunals on campus.
So, and do they have any like actual forensic evidence? If these people are bureaucrats, do they have any expertise in that kind of thing?
They are trained. And one of the interesting, so this is one of the orders of the Obama administration, was all of these people have to be trained. And the equivalent would be in the criminal justice process. Imagine if in rape trials, all juries who handled rape cases had to be trained, and the only training that they were allowed to look at was training that was given by the prosecutor that would make it more likely that they would come up with a guilty finding. And that's essentially what this training is. It's, you know, it's sort of one-sided, and it doesn't really help. There's no forensic investigation. Colleges and universities don't have the legal authority to subpoena evidence. And so what they're doing is making these life-altering...
Oh, well, that tells you everything right there.
Right. On the basis of incomplete evidentiary basis. They're basically just guessing.
Wow. Wow. So if you're a young man in college right now, you better make sure you don't connect with some girl that, you know, is feeling hysterical. I mean, a lot of these, I would imagine, you know, I went to college, you know, a lot of these things are real, of course. I mean, we, you know, acknowledge some are real.
Absolutely.
But then there are the, I got drunk at a party last night and don't remember what I did.
Right.
And somebody must have done something bad to me, and it was probably you. And you can't get out from under that.
Right. The vast majority of the cases that we look at in the book, and you know, we looked at the files and read more than 100 cases and write about around 50 of these cases, are cases where, you know, it's a one-night hookup. Both the male and the female students were drinking, usually drinking to, you know, considerable excess.
Not in college.
Sometimes these allegations come months or even years after the incident, and so there's, you know, to the extent that there were witnesses, you know, generally, if you've been to a drunken party 18 months ago, and you know, you're not going to remember what went on with two other people who happened to be at the party. So, you know, it's a system where they're operating on very a weak evidentiary basis, and critically in the college context, you know, college students do use, you know, they text a lot, they use social media in a variety of ways, but colleges can't subpoena any of this. And so none of the relevant electronic evidence makes its way to any of these campus tribunals.
And when did this all begin? Under the Obama administration?
Yes. So the guidance came in April of 2011. And it's part of a general shift by Obama after the 2010 midterms, which, you know, as we all remember, you know, were a fiasco for the Democrats. But one state they did very well in was in Colorado. And in Colorado, they did well in part by appealing on social issues. And so if you think back to 2011, 2012, Obama starts embracing a whole bunch of left-leaning social issues. You know, marriage for same-sex couples, Dreamers, the contraceptive mandate as part of Obamacare. And this is part of that shift towards a more aggressive approach towards social issues. And in this case, the thinking seems to have been this will energize the feminist base in the run-up to the 2012 election. So you have a law that had been on the books for 39 years. Title IX is passed in 1972. And all of a sudden in 2011, out of the blue, this federal office in the Education Department called the Office for Civil Rights produces a letter which they sent to every college and university in the country saying, we have now decided that Title IX gives us the authority for you to, you have to use lower evidence, you have to discourage cross-examination, you have to give accusers the ability to appeal a not guilty finding in these campus tribunals. And if you don't do what we say, we'll pull all of your federal money from you. And so colleges and universities had no choice but to comply.
And so if you're accused and found guilty, do you get to appeal? Or is it only the girls get to appeal?
Both sides get to appeal.
Do you a lot of good, but
it will do you no good. I mean, generally the appeals go to the Title IX officer or someone else within the campus administration, and your chances of winning an appeal for the accused are very, very slim. You know, in part because administrators tend to be very sympathetic ideologically to accusers, but in part because administrators live in fear that if they find someone not guilty, they'll get a Title IX complaint against the school, and then the school will have to be investigated by the federal government, which costs lots of money and takes lots of time.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think I would want to have a young man in college right now, or be a young man in college. That sounds it is decidedly frightening. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Casey Johnson, who's co-author of the book, The Campus Rape Frenzy. And so before you send me hate mail, we get that this does happen, but in a lot of cases it doesn't. So we're going to talk about those today. So just so we know where we are going forward, you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Now that was a ball. You had some of the best times you'll never remember with me. Alcohol.
And that's where all the problems start. Shouldn't make fun, but we're going to, because that's what we do. Casey, so how many of these cases that you looked at, how many of these do you think the people were actually innocent?
We've looked at around 100 and between 100 and 120 cases, and in almost all of these cases, the guys were innocent. Now, these are cases in which there were lawsuits that were filed by the accused students who were wrongfully found guilty. There's no good data in terms of, you know, what percentage of claims are actually false. But there is a good study that was just out by a professor at UCLA that showed that if you're innocent, you know, in one of these tribunals, you have at least a 1 in 3 chance of being found guilty because of the standard that they use and the minimal protections that you have for your rights, which, you know, is a really frightening total.
And it isn't like this isn't a black mark like on your school record. This is literally a felony on your public police record. And then are you considered are you a sex offender if you attack
a
grown up?
See, that's the interesting thing about this. There is technically no law enforcement element here, although police are free to subpoena these records if they choose. What there is, though, so there's a black mark on your academic record.
Okay.
You're kicked out. And effectively, your life is permanently altered. So you put yourself in the position of one of these guys, again, who's not guilty but has been wrongfully found guilty. So you have a record saying, you know, you've been found guilty of sexual assault by your college. You're not going to be able to transfer schools because what school is going to take in someone who has been deemed a rapist? Any job that you're trying to get after, for the rest of your life that has a background check, you're not going to get that job either, because what employer in their right mind is going to hire someone who has been deemed a rapist by their institution? So these are life-altering effects outside of the criminal justice process. I mean, they don't need to register with the state or anything like this. But if you project this out, you know, these are decisions that are, you know, would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in earning capabilities, and you know, will be with these guys for the rest of their lives.
Jeez, Louise. So if you're a student or a parent of a student, your recourse is zero because this is happening at all schools in the country.
This is happening at all schools. There are a couple. The only way to avoid these tribunals is not to have any kind of sexual or romantic contact with a student from your own school. And in the real world, you know, there's just no way that's going to happen. The one area where accused students have enjoyed some success. Colleges don't want lawyers involved in these processes for understandable reasons, because the processes are kind of rigged. And in some instances, students who have been accused immediately hire a lawyer. The lawyer tries to go to court to try to get the process frozen or to force the universities to negotiate in some respects. But in general, once you're accused, you're in very, very dire straits.
Wow. So your Stephen had sent me, some information here. So I guess their studies say that 1 in 5 women is a victim of sexual assault. Is that what they're peddling?
Yes, this is what the Obama administration has promoted, and it's based on a 2007 survey of two of the more than 7,000 colleges and universities around in the country. And if you project that out, because they prefer to just use this 1 in 5 figure.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean that there are between 400,000 and 500,000 female undergraduates every year who are sexually assaulted on college campuses, but no one notices because the actual total seems to be around 5,000 at most per year. So the argument is that from the administration is that we have this epidemic that the typical college campus has a much, much higher rate of violent crime, because sexual assault is a violent crime, than anywhere else in the country. So, Detroit, Oakland, St. Louis, Baltimore, the cities that the FBI lists as the most dangerous cities in the country, they don't hold a candle in terms of violent crime to Cal Berkeley or Stanford or USC or UCLA, because according to the Obama administration, which is, of course, crazy. No one in their right mind would believe this. But then the kicker is that our campuses are this crime zone, but we do not want police involved here at all. We're going to handle this through Title IX bureaucrats, and they'll investigate, and they'll prosecute, and they'll conduct the tribunals. So it's a really absurd claim once you sort of dig down and look at it. But this is the argument that was presented, by Obama, accepted by most leading figures in California. Key law passed in California by Feinstein, by Boxer, by Kamala Harris, and by most in the media.
Jeez, I don't see any way to unwind this unless the federal government drops. What kind of a process will it be to unravel this, do you think?
It's a great question, and it's not going to be an easy process to unravel.
There are
a couple of ways that it may at least begin to get a little fairer. The first is that Obama issued a lot of, and it wasn't just on the campus sexual assault issue. Obama issued a lot of executive orders and guidance that went outside the bounds of usual governmental authority. So Trump or Betsy DeVos, the current education secretary, if they wanted, they could repeal this guidance tomorrow. Because the Obama guidance in 2011, and then there was supplementary guidance in 2014, didn't go through a notice and comment period. It wasn't issued as a formal federal regulation. It was just issued as a letter. So DeVos could write a letter tomorrow saying, we no longer are going to follow this guidance. That wouldn't get things fairer, but at least it would remove the federal pressure. The other thing is that lots of these cases have worked their way into the court system, and those really are the sources for the book. The one thing that people often don't understand is that when you think of a trial, one of the key checks in a trial is that it's occurring in the open. So if the prosecution is behaving corruptly, the media, the public can be in the courtroom and they can witness this this problem. Campus tribunals are always secret. There's no public involvement at all as a result of federal privacy law. And so these lawsuits are really the only way where we get inside these systems and see just how unfair they are. And so judges have to be aggressive in basically telling colleges and universities, you have to be fair when you're handling these issues, and if you're not, we're going to issue decisions on behalf of accused students. And there have been around 70 judicial decisions around the country in the last 5 years. Most of those have been won by accused students. But, you know, going to court takes years.
Right.
It's very expensive. And, you know, a system where your best chance of vindicating your innocence is a 2 or 3 or 4 year lawsuit is not a system that we would think of as a model system.
No. That's crazy. By then hopefully they're out of school.
Right.
Do the accusers in these ever recant?
Generally, no. One of the ways in which the campus environment is so different than the rest of the country, I mean, the issue of sexual assault and rape is one in which, in society as a whole, there are lots of reasons that rape victims do not want to come forward, and in which at least certain quarters of the broader culture really discourage rape victims from coming forward. But that's not the case on college campuses. There is the reverse is true almost. There's this relentless pressure from administrators, from sort of campus organizations that, you know, you'll be protected if you come forward and this sort of thing. And so accusers who come forward have this enormous support network on campus that they're able to receive. So very, very rarely do you see any kind of recantation, because if they did that, they would be discredited in the eyes of their new campus associates.
Wow. And how much of this, if not all, is supported by the, you know, kind of the hardcore feminist, I don't know, I mean, I would call them man-haters, because most of them are, but
right,
is that the crux of it?
It's a combination of ideologues and sort of kind of self-serving bureaucrats. There's a lot of money in this. Harvard, for instance, currently has 50 staffers, 50, devoted solely to the issue of Title IX and Title IX enforcement.
Wow.
So, you know, if your salary depends, and, you know, you figure most of these people are making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. If your salary depends on finding an epidemic of campus rapes, you're going to sure well find there's an epidemic of campus rapes. So there's a lot of careerism within this movement in higher education. Administration is the fastest area of growing area of employment on campuses, far faster than faculty or in other support staffs. And so you have this pernicious combination in many ways of ideologues, you know, people who believe that women just never lie about sexual assault, and so the goal has to be to set up a system that vindicates their claims, and then people whose jobs depend on this system that's been imposed over the last 5 or 6 years, and if there are changes, that means they're going to have to find, you know, other employment.
It's bad when you embed it in the system and it isn't about justice. It's really about covering your career.
Right.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, another reason we won't see it go away anytime soon. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would love to hear some maybe examples of that you found, you know, while you guys were writing the book, some cases where you were just like, oh. And I'm curious where this happens, if there is any frequency to it. The South, the East, the West, you know, is it on public, you know what I mean? In the university system, or is it in public school or state schools? I'm curious about all that, how it pans out. All right, we'll be right back with our guest, J.C. Johnson, Casey Johnson, who is the author of The Campus Rape Frenzy. And you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
time I've known you, I still don't know what you mean. The weekend at the college didn't turn out like you planned. The things that pass for knowledge I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine?
Obviously, the musical challenges today have been overcome by Bob Martin. Nice overcoming, Bob.
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge for this hour, at least.
I'm like, what are you going to play for music? Oh, my gosh. So, you're listening to the ever-irreverent We the People Radio, where political correctness is not allowed, obviously. And we wanted to thank our sponsor. We might as well throw them under the bus and confess our affiliation with Powerhouse Solar. Those guys were founded in 2003 by Bruce and Susan Blake. They've grown into the North State's premier solar company. Family began business out of a passion to help people reduce energy costs and protect the environment, and remains true to its core value of treating every customer with integrity, honesty, and care. They're very nice. And they're right up there in Shasta Lake, 530-275-5600 or powerhousesolar.com. There we go. I forgot that for now 35 minutes, but I just remembered that's Bill's part. Bill's not here today. It's hard when I have to be two people. So much pressure. All right. So our guest, Casey Johnson, author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, and I know we've heard some of this in the news and whatnot, but honestly, I didn't have any idea it was this bad. I didn't realize they rewrote all the rules of law as it applies on campuses and all that. So give us some examples. How bad does it get for some of these folks?
Sure. So the way to think of how the college system works is that essentially an accused student is presumed guilty and generally is denied the chance to prove his innocence. It's really not a pleasant process. So I'll give you one example, a case at Amherst College up in Massachusetts, where a male student is drinking. He was drinking very, very heavily, and he encounters his girlfriend's roommate in the common area of their dorm. The girlfriend is away for the weekend. And the roommate suggests that they go back to their room and have sex. And they do. It turns out that the roommate recognizes the guy was very, very drunk. The roommate recognizes immediately she's made a terrible mistake. And she's texting a friend of hers, this is on the night of the incident, saying, made a terrible mistake. We need to come up with a good lie, and she uses the phrase lie in her text to avoid this problem. But then she has other things on her mind. She has another male student coming over to her room to have sex with him later on that evening. And Amherst is a small college. People find out about what happened. She loses all of her friends. And she falls in with the campus victims' rights organization. And around 18 months later, she says that none of this happened the way it claimed on the text, that she was sexually assaulted.
Twice or once?
Right. And she, by student number one. And she files a complaint through Amherst. The college says, do you want to go to police? And she says, absolutely not, because, of course, if she went to police, the text messages would come out.
Right.
So she does she does her complaint. She is asked, do you have any relevant text messages about what happened that night? She says, no, nothing at all. And Amherst can't require her to turn it over. And so they hold a hearing. There are three Title IX-related bureaucrats at this hearing. She admits at the hearing that she did text that evening, but they don't ask her for the text. She does admit that she had someone come over to her room after the incident with the first guy, but says that it wasn't to have sex with them. It was to comfort her after she had been assaulted. So you have someone who was simply lying and whose own text from the night in question would show that she was lying.
Right.
But Amherst didn't have the text. So they find the guy guilty. They kick him out. A couple months later, he he is able to track down the text, incredibly with the help of his ex-girlfriend, who is, you know, who is just outraged at what's happened, turns the text over to Amherst. Amherst's response is, well, it's too late. We don't care about this evidence. And then their investigator in court says that even if she had these texts, it wouldn't matter because Amherst's investigation only was concerned with finding texts that would corroborate the accuser's story. That is, that they just wanted evidence that would show the guy was guilty, evidence that was that showed the guy was innocent they weren't interested in seeing.
And they actually said that in open court?
They said that in court, right.
Wow.
And the argument that the investigator made is that people often don't realize when they are instantly realize that they are sexually assaulted. So if they've written something from the night in question that talks about how they weren't sexually assaulted, which was the case here, that evidence is irrelevant because they can later change their minds, which is simply it's a crazy line of argument in this particular case where, you know, where the evidence was clear from the text as to what was going on. So the guy sued. This incident happened in 2014. In February, the judge in Massachusetts allowed the lawsuit to go forward. It's scheduled for trial sometime late next year. So this guy's life has been a hold for 4 years in a case where he was clearly innocent. And if anything, he was, according to Amherst policies, a victim of sexual assault because under Amherst policies, someone who is incapacitated, which he was because of his level of drinking, can't form consent. And the accuser claimed that she had initiated the sexual contact, but then later suggested she withdrew during the act. So it's a good case of showing how the college's inability to acquire relevant evidence leads to these guilty findings. It's the case at Ohio State. Guy is 4 months away from getting his MD. So he's, you know, he's done all of his medical school, background. He's, you know, he's in the hospital doing his final training, and he's accused of sexual assault. It turns out that he had slept with his accuser around a year before. 2 days before she accuses him, she has been informed by Ohio State that she's going to be kicked out because of bad grades. And so she goes to the Title IX office and tells the Title IX officer that 10 months before she had gone out to a bar with this guy and that he had sexually assaulted her, and that because she had been sexually assaulted, she says she demands an accommodation, and the accommodation is that she not be kicked out.
Well, that's a neat deal.
Right. Really, really good if you had her as your doctor.
Yeah, no kidding.
And she's granted the accommodation. The Title IX officer does not tell the hearing board at Ohio State that the accuser had made this allegation only 2 days after she had been told she was going to be kicked out, that, you know, that she had this powerful motive to lie. So the hearing board finds the guy guilty. They kick him out. He sues Ohio State. There's a hearing that's held in a federal court in Ohio, and three Ohio State administrators are asked, do you consider it to be your job to get the decision right? And all three of them won't answer yes to that question. There's one Ohio State administrator, and this is a public university, who is asked, if you are aware that a student is lying during these hearings, do you believe it's your obligation to come forward and say, you know, this person is lying? And the administrators, a victim's advocate, said no, that was not her job.
Wow. So getting to the truth is not one of the, that's not one of the choices?
It's not. It is wholly secondary. The whole thrust of these systems is to ensure that the accusing student is treated with dignity and with respect, which of course any accusing student
well,
should
right.
be. But
unless they're lying, at which point we upend them and yeah.
Right. So Stuart and I started researching this book, you know, in 2012. We are not aware of a single case anywhere in the country where a college or university, there are some cases in the criminal justice system, where a college and university has filed a claim against an accusing student for making a false sexual assault allegation. So this is a system where there is no deterrent to false claims at all. And that, you know, that really is sort of what you see reflected in these sorts of cases where, you know, they're not interested in the truth. The truth is secondary to their motivations at best.
Was the accuser in the Duke rape case charged with making a false statement?
She was not. Although the Duke rape case was an interesting twist because the case went to the Attorney General of North Carolina, who conducted a comprehensive investigation, you know, made a public proclamation that the guys were innocent, and then said that he seriously he looked into the question of whether she should be filed with whether she should be charged with filing a false police report, and he gave two arguments as to why he didn't charge her, and I think he was probably correct in this. The first is that she was mentally imbalanced, and so, you know, that he would have to prove that she had an intent to lie, and she may be able to just have claimed that she was, you know, a lunatic. And then secondly, nice. He was worried that there would be public protests and wanted to avoid that. It turns out she's in jail now anyway because she murdered her her future boyfriend.
She really was a man hater.
To
the core.
She was convicted of arson for trying to after the rape case, she hooked up with some guy, tried to burn his apartment down. She was convicted of arson. Then she hooked up with another guy who she murdered, and she got a close to a 20-year sentence.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I guess...
Why did she plead insanity?
She tried in that case, but that was rejected.
They were like, yeah, maybe not.
She only got 20 years?
It was a second-degree murder charge.
Jeez, well, we ought to watch out for her in the future.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, since I'm the only woman in the mix here, I just want to say this is embarrassing. You know, I mean, it's the wrong word, but I mean, this is just, it's horrible. There's no way that this should be, that we should be telling young women that this is appropriate or this is how women act or these are, like, rights that women should have or whatever the heck they're pushing. I mean, that's crazy. The rule of law is the rule of law. Right is still right. Wrong is still wrong. You don't get to just, I'm a woman, so, you know, I don't understand how that creates any kind of equality. And so, right. I'm sorry, I don't expect you to answer that, but I just hate this feminist thing. Okay, so what kind of punishment can these courts do? Oh, I guess we have to take a break, but we'll wait a minute. What kind of punishment these little tribunals on the campus do they get to put people in jail?
They expel. So that's the extent of their punishment.
And
this is a critical but. All of these records can be subpoenaed by the police. So the worst case scenario is that this serves as a way of getting around Miranda warnings and other constitutional protections for accused students. But in most of these cases, it simply it leads to expulsion. And then the permanent branding on their educational record of these students as committed sexual assault.
So if you you're a young guy, this happens to you when you're in college, you get expelled, you go to apply for a job. Do you have to say that you've been arrested? Does this count as? This seems
is going to require you to turn over your transcript. And the transcript is going to have some kind of indication that you've been found culpable for sexual assault, and your chances of getting that job are going to go out the window. So essentially, for students who are found guilty in these tribunals, their employment options are limited to places that do not have background checks or do not require you to supply your transcript as part of your job application.
So, President of the United States.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So Obama could, you know, set the precedent there. When we come back, I'm really curious to know why you think that our colleges and universities feel that it's a good idea to teach students or to model for students, however you want to do it, that civil liberties don't count. that's a zero-sum game. If you're a girl, you win. If you're a guy, you get kicked out. You can blame anybody for anything, and it's nuts. Makes me angry. I'm going to take 2 minutes of anger management. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We have all the information about Casey Johnson and his book, The Campus Rape Frenzy.
Some people run from a possible fight. Some people figure they can never win. And although this is a fight I can lose, the accused is an innocent man.
There you go, Casey. If you ever decide to do your book as a musical, you can use that as your as your intro song.
Right.
So colleges, they're making safe spaces. It's like preschool, except the consequences are huge, especially on a thing like this.
Right.
So nobody has to own up to their own behavior. Nobody has to follow the rules. Laws don't count, and they're living literally in a bizarre, twisted bubble that has nothing to do with reality.
Right.
What the heck? I know because we've interviewed some of them. There are some students that are like, I just got to get this piece of paper and get the heck out of here. I've got a bunch of nieces and nephews who managed to squeak through, you know, just like, get there, get the degree, get out.
Right.
Why are we not teaching our up-and-coming adults that civil liberties matter?
I think part of it is that you have at most campuses, and there's an important gap on this issue between elite schools, Ivy League, elite liberal arts colleges, prominent research universities, areas where the faculty in particular is very involved in setting campus culture, and the rest of the colleges and universities. And at the upper tier schools in particular, there's this sense that the United States is a society that's deeply sexist and racist and classist, it's an oppressive society, and that it's the job of colleges and universities to undo that depression, that students come in not recognizing that they're part of the oppressive society. And so things, basic civil liberties like the First Amendment or due process protections are instruments of the patriarchy and are instruments of power that need to be subordinated. It's a very frightening attitude towards foundational American principles. We've seen a lot in these campus protests where the argument is that free speech needs to be subordinated to the creation of these safe zones on campus where students are not, where we make sure that students don't hear anything that might in any way offend them. And this movement on due process issues is it flows from that same impulse that students, especially in this case female students, are weak, that they need to be protected, and that the college needs to sort of walk them through and inform them that they're victims of sexual assault. Because part of the underpinnings here is that students, female students, don't realize when they're sexually assaulted.
Right.
They need lots of education by the colleges to let them know these things. So it's a paternalistic movement, but the idea is that the guidelines need to be set by these administrators and by certain kinds of left-leaning faculty on identity politics issues.
Well, it's pathetic because at the end of the day, these people wouldn't make it 5 miles on the Oregon Trail.
Right, right.
I mean, if we, that's always our standard, you know, how many miles, you know, we actually at work, you know, kind of hold up the fingers, like how many miles would they have made it?
Right.
I mean, that's just, it's sad. We're talking about empowerment and they want equal pay for equal work. Well, they can't do equal work because we're teaching them to be complete idiots.
Right, right. Yeah, they're not learning important lessons. I mean, they're learning.
Well, they're not dealing
really
with reality. Can you imagine hiring one of these people?
Yeah, they're being taught that civil liberties are bad. And
right.
That's a frightening lesson to learn.
That they should be able to stomp their little feet and recreate reality, and that makes it real. And then they go out in the real world. Imagine what a shock it's going to be the first time they go to an office and somebody says, yeah, it doesn't work that way here. Oh, my gosh. You have to do a secondary book. You know, the reality check. I bet it's shocking for them when they go out and try to get jobs. And I bet most of them are going to be unemployed.
They'll be so triggered.
Yeah. The triggering will be huge.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Well, well, I'm going to be mad all day now. Hope you're happy. So, Casey Johnson and your book with Stuart Taylor, The Campus Rape Frenzy, sounds like a must read because apparently our civilization is almost over.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a million. You can find all the information about the book, the authors, and everything else. We'll be here at second hour as well at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And Bill is down at the Shasta County Fairgrounds selling tractors today. Mostly he's standing in the rain, actually. If we want to be accurate in our reporting, he's mostly just standing in the rain. But we just finished a stressful hour. We decided it was good that there were no bars nearby, even though it's a little early in the day.
Actually, there is one down the street.
No, we're not going to talk about that. We had Casey Johnson on with us about the campus rape frenzy, and it was enough to light your hair on fire. So, please go to the archives if you missed that and need to have your hair lit on fire. I did meet a guy who does take medication to raise his blood pressure. I thought, oh my gosh. We have a program for him. He no longer needs medication.
I was going to say, he could get off his meds if he just listened to us.
Absolutely. He could just be done with that whole thing. So our second hour, as if that was...
By the way, if Tractor Bill were here, he would tell you that the program is sponsored by...
By Powerhouse Solar, Bruce and Sue Blake. They were founded in 2003. They've grown into the North State's premier solar company. You can find them at 275-5600. That is area code 530. And online, powerhousesolar.com. Ta-da! Okay. Thanks, Bob. Thanks for being the dad. Keeping us on track here.
Between us, we'll cover for Bill.
Exactly. All right. So as if the first hour was not stressful enough, we're going to talk about another new book called DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington. Okay, the good news is we're only talking about five tricks, so we probably won't have anyone's head explode, but I've never met our guest, so we'll see about that. David Schoenbrod, yes?
Exactly.
No.
You got it right.
I wrote to Steve, and I'm like, yikes, panic attack at midnight. I forgot to find out how his name is pronounced, because it's Schoenbrod, which is tricky.
Right.
Schoenbrod.
So, a problem my whole life.
Well, my husband's last name is Cundiff, C-U-N-D-I-F-F. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm Aaron Ryan. So, I guess you could, you know, take your wife's name or something and get out of it, but probably not. So, okay, DC Confidential showed up for you. Why? Like, what made you want to do this? Besides the frustration of watching Washington.
Because these five tricks apply to everything government does, it made my hair go on fire.
Oh,
and
there you go.
And that's what got me going on this thing. I mean, listen, we all know that politicians are tricksters. So how do they get away with promising something for nothing or very little? That's what interested me. And the answer is for the same reason that magicians can seem to pull rabbits out of hats. We don't see the sleights of hand, even though we do know they're tricksters. So what I try to do in this book is reveal the sleights of hand. And they came through a new system that Congress and the presidents of both parties began to develop in the late 1960s. And this new system uses five tricks that lets them make rosy promises but avoid blame for bad consequences.
Interesting.
And that's why we have such a crummy government.
Interesting.
I mean, before these tricks began, 76% of voters trusted our government to do the right thing. Now only 19% do. And that's because the government ain't doing the right thing.
Well, and it can't be helping that we have, 7,000 channels with 24-hour fear porn playing. we're not actually getting a lot of news in a lot of cases. We're getting all sorts of crazy stuff. So,
right, but think about where that comes from. I mean, if what these people that we elect were doing was making hard choices about trade-offs, then there'd be real news. I mean, I remember when I was a youngster, and I'm sure I'm much older than you, congressional elections would be decided. What?
I'm 55, so.
I'm a generation older than you.
Okay.
I remember when congressional elections were decided on the basis of hard choices that officials made about laws. Now, they don't really vote on hard choices. They vote on, I'm against pollution killing children, or I'm against regulation killing jobs. But they never talk about the inevitable trade-offs between them. And so they're just talking about sound bites. So that's why we don't have any real news.
True. And, well, back in the day, too, I mean, even when I was a kid, news was on for like an hour. Because I remember we couldn't, we had to listen to my dad yell at the TV for an hour. And, it's like, oh, good, the news is on. But it stopped. I mean, it went on, and then it was gone. And so they had to crush all the information of the day into an hour. So they really had to be picky. And now they're just kind of, talking to hear their heads roar 24 hours a day. And a lot of, I love these ones where we have a big storm and they want to talk about the big storm. Now it hasn't even come yet, but we're going to talk about the big storm for 3 days beforehand.
I got a complaint about media too, but I think the ultimate problem here is that a republic is based upon, number one, our electing officials, and
right.
Number two, the officials that we elect making the major decisions of policy and being responsible for the consequences.
Correct.
And the second part is gone. So I don't care what kind of news you got.
Yeah, true.
We don't have a government that responds to us.
Talk. I don't know where you want to start with this. Which way do you want to go? You want to talk about the five tricks? Because I have those listed. I never have this much information.
Yeah,
it's kind of fun.
A good place to start.
All right. Fire away.
Okay. Well, the first of them is what I call the money trick. And a half century ago, it began to work in Washington. The trip began a half century ago, where politicians began to promise us future medical care or tax cuts or whatever, but they began to hide the costs. In the past, they didn't hide the costs because they had to impose the taxes to pay for the stuff.
Right, but now they can defer it, till later.
Kick the can down the road. They let their successors in office be responsible for either the tax increases or spending cuts needed to make ends meet in the long run. And you can contrast what they're doing here with what Congress requires of moneylenders. A moneylender can't make a loan without revealing in writing to the borrower how much they're going to have to pay in the long run. Well, Congress doesn't really provide us with that information, so we don't really know how much our taxes are going to have to go up or the benefits going to go down to make ends meet. And if we knew that, we could hold them accountable for the cost of the promises they're making now.
Sure, and because those things should kick in today, not 5 years or seven. I guess I'm thinking specifically of, the Affordable Care Act thing. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things kicking in this year and next. Well, if they would have been there the first year, then it would have been a far worse deal. It would have been slightly more obvious, I guess.
Absolutely.
And there are a zillion examples.
There's a lot of costs they have taken, because they have the Congressional Budget Office they order it to do a lot of the accounting in terms of what's going to happen over the next 10 years, because they're pretending to be responsible for the future. But they structure a lot of stuff so the costs occur more than 10 years from now, but the revenues come in earlier.
Right. So it looks like it's all going great, and then it starts to implode, and people wonder why.
Right. Yeah. If a private corporation kept books the way the federal government did, they'd be put in jail under the fraud provisions of the Securities and Exchange Act. So I want to have the same kind of requirements that Congress applies to money lenders and corporations apply to Congress, so they reveal to us up front the costs of what they're, the long-term costs of what they're giving us now.
Sure.
Simple, and obvious problem, obvious solution. And I got a proposed statute called the Honest Deal Act that requires them to solve this, to stop this trick and the other tricks with analogously easy,
sure,
obvious ways.
Well, okay, so we have to take a really quick break, but what I'm thinking is, okay, for the most part, I think all of us can figure out that if they're deferring cost until later, so it looks nice now, but it looks crummy later, I mean, we can all figure out why that happens. When we come back, I'd like to know if there are any instances where that was done for a good reason, other than just some sort of sleight of hand, because you've researched it longer than I have. So
yeah,
we're going to draw upon your experience. We're going to be right back. You are listening to We the People Radio. Please join us online. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We will be right back with the author of DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, can't just destroy your life. Oh, promises, those kind of promises take all the joy from life.
And who was that?
Dionne Warwick.
Oh, how did I not know that? Good one. We've moved into show tunes. It's fantastic. we're here with our guest, David.
We don't do 60s too often, but that was one of her early hits.
We do a lot of 70s. So, okay, so now we're into 60s. That's fun. So David Schoenbrod has written a book called DC Confidential. And I forgot to tell you a little bit about him. He's a renowned policy expert and author of the new book, DC Confidential. He is trustee professor of law at New York Law School. He is the leader of Natural Resources Defense Council, heading campaigns to get the lead out of gasoline, protect the environment in Puerto Rico, and protect New Yorkers from automotive air pollution. And here we go. You've been Wall Street Journal, New York Times, other newspapers. You have other books, Power Without Responsibility. Kind of sounds like similar. Democracy by Decree, Saving the Environment from Washington, and Breaking the Logjam. That's kind of awesome. You've been a busy bee.
Yeah. Scribble, scribble, scribble.
We'll just encapsulate that. You've been a busy bee. Okay, so is there ever a time when they push the cost off until later, but there's a reason we did that and it was actually not bad?
Yeah. I mean, the cost of fighting World War II. I mean, we borrowed a lot of money in order to win the war, but after the war, Congress began to run some surpluses for a while, and the debt as a share of gross national product went down substantially. And one could argue, and I don't have any question that that made sense. There are other cases where Congress spent money but didn't come up with the taxes to pay for everything, like dealing with the Great Depression, and that's somewhat more controversial. But my point here is not that Congress in any one instance or not should shift blame to future Congresses for the cost of things it's doing now. My point is they ought to be just open with us about what the costs are.
Sure.
To give us an accounting of how much we're going to have to pay. Then the voters could decide whether this is appropriate. But what they're doing now is hiding the cost, which biases government to do more stuff. So we got a bigger government that's less responsive to our interests.
Sure, and it looks like it's not really hurting us because the pain is coming later.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It really is hurting us, and the bigger that debt gets, the more the pain has a present impact. And as I'm sure your voters understand, that if the government keeps kicking the can down the road, ultimately there's going to have to be huge tax increases and spending cuts in the future that are going to imperil the ability of our children to earn a living.
Yep.
They're going to imperil our Medicare and Social Security and crash the economy. So we got to begin to deal with it now. So I want an accounting from them as to what it's going to cost and how much more it's going to cost if they keep putting it off. And they could do that, and that's what my Honest Deal Act would tell them to do.
Yeah, take a snapshot of where we are and how much is this really going to cost us going forward.
Exactly, and I want it reported in terms of what it's going to do to the average family, because they can send us a letter every year from Social Security telling us how much they're going to give us. Well, tell us how much it's going to cost us. We
right.
may find out it's going to cost us more than that Social Security check to get the Social Security check.
Right, right. Well, and there are all these things, it seems, that, you know, we want, and I'm going to use the term we loosely, but, you know, we want more and more and more. We want the government to do more and more and more. And yet nobody seems to be factoring in that somebody's got to pay for that.
Right. So, I mean, the consequence of these five tricks, every one of them, is government ends up doing more. I mean, another trick I call the federal mandate trick is where they order the states and local governments to do stuff, things that are popular. So Congress gets the credit for the popular stuff getting delivered to us. But in this instance, they shift the blame to state and local officials.
Sure. And so what's the example that's in your mind about that?
Well, the Clean Air Act says that unless the state cleans the air the way the federal EPA says it should be cleaned, the state loses the federal highway grant, which is just awfully punishing to the state, especially since the state taxpayers paid for it through their federal taxes.
Right.
So the federal government and the states have to knuckle under.
So the
credit goes to, once again, the credit goes to members of Congress, and the blame gets shifted elsewhere to the state officials who are going to have to impose the burdensome regulations.
Sure. And then a lot of times the federal funding runs out on these types of things, and the states are left to continue to shoulder it. Same with counties and towns. I mean, we see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, for example, with the Clean Air Act, there is some federal funding to pay for the regulatory officials at the state level, but there's nothing to make up for the blame that the governor has to bear for imposing the regulations on the industry and the jobs that are lost. So in that instance, it isn't the lack of, and then on a number of the other mandates where the states have to do things like provide special ed or something like that,
sure,
the feds don't really pay for most of the cost.
No.
So the blame for the cost falls on the state officials.
Whether they can afford it or not. And they have
exactly.
no ability to modify that or disregard it because it's a one-size-fits-all mandate you must do.
Exactly. So instead of having what states and localities do respond to the wishes of their own voters, they respond to what's laid down in Washington, often by federal regulatory agencies.
Yes, and we have plenty of those, don't we?
Mm-hmm. That's another trick. The regulation trick where Congress promises rights to whatever kind of regulatory protections seem popular at the time, but the blame for the burdens needed to make that happen, that falls on the agency because Congress tells the agency to impose the duties needed to fulfill the rights. So again, Congress gets the credit. The agencies, somebody else gets the blame.
Yeah, and what about the agencies that have sort of, you know, we've watched them over the last, you know, decade or so. They sort of are swinging a bigger stick and charging out on their own a little bit. Like, what do you think about this, you know, the new effort to cut back on federal regulation?
I hear what you're saying. Okay, so it is true that agencies have a degree of discretion, so they could do more or less with the powers that Congress has given them. But President Trump could take care of that by appointing people to run these agencies that shared his regulatory philosophy.
Right.
So you have to ask yourself the question, why else then does he need this executive order that says that agencies must cut out two regulations for every one they issue? Well, that's kind of saying, isn't it, that the fault lies with the agencies, even agencies run by people I, President Trump, appoint, right? But think about why the agencies do so much stuff. It isn't just that they are run by over-aggressive regulators. It's that Congress and past presidents have ordered the agencies to do stuff. Like, for example, in the Clean Air Act, there's 940 separate commands to the EPA administrator to regulate. And many of these commands require dozens of different regulations. So Congress and the president end up blaming the, and this is true under Democrats and Republicans, they blame the agency for the regulatory burdens, but most of the time, Congress required them to impose the burdens.
Sure. And then on the flip side, like I can think of one, this one just always sticks in me. Here you have a rider that was put in, I think it was in an appropriations bill, I forget, but it was one sentence that said that the Army Corps of Engineers could not regulate ongoing farming. Because out here where we are, every time you get a quasi-flat piece of ground and you have a little dent in it and some water collects, the Army Corps of Engineers wants to regulate whether they can grow wheat or whatever. I mean, it's been farming ground for 100 years. So this thing passes that they're no longer allowed to regulate ongoing farming practices. So they jack up farmers in our area here in far northern California. The congressional office goes to the Army Corps of Engineers. They all have a sit down and they say, hey, look, here's this one sentence. Because people are always saying how the rules are too complicated, the bills are too long, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's one sentence, pretty straightforward. And the Army Corps of Engineers said that's not how they read that.
Oh, God.
That was their response. That's not how we read that. So they're going to keep doing what they're going to be doing. And it's like, oh, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
But the regulatory framework has turned into, just a monster. It's got a life of its own.
And you got to ask yourself the question why, and the answer is that the politicians want to get credit for the vote with the voters who want more who want regulatory protection. So, I mean, the point is we resent the burdens of regulation, but also many voters want regulatory protection, and because the incentives of the members of Congress are all to get credit and shift blame. They don't write the statutes in a way that does a reasonable job of reconciling our competing desires for regulatory protection and avoiding regulatory burdens. So we get an unduly complex system, the kind of system that has 940 separate commands on air pollution to EPA. It's woefully complicated, woefully overexpensive. It's just truly a stupid system.
Right.
And they don't fix it because all the blame for all the bad consequences fall on the agency.
Sure. Well,
so, I mean, this is what prompted me to write the present book, is I got together with a whole bunch of other folks on the left and right who thought that our environmental statutes were obsolete and stupid, and we came up with a set of proposals for how to update them to make them smarter, and we went to members of Congress and Democrats and Republicans, and they all said, you know, we think your proposals are great. We wish they were on the statute books, but, you know, my colleagues in Congress, they don't really want to be responsible. So we're not going to pass these things.
Wow.
That's what got me to write this book.
Yeah, no kidding. That'd be like, wait a minute, what? Yeah, because if they're,
it's all in terms of what
distressing.
It does for them, not in terms of what it does for their constituents.
Sure, and for those, I don't know, I mean, we see it a lot with our natural resources up here, but if anybody even mentions that they're going to look at EPA regulation, for instance, everybody freaks out. They're trying to get rid of the EPA. If they talk about Social Security, just all you have to do is mention it. And, phones all light on fire everywhere. They're getting rid of Social Security for everyone. We're all going to die. It's just, so touching it, like even like touching these things is a risk.
Well, the thing is, I think that we, the people, would like more sensible arrangements, but the politicians, from their point of view, it's irrational to take responsibility, because if they take responsibility for hard choices, they're going to be up against an opponent who is going to, you know, be willing to play the tricks and blame them for, the opponent's going to say, I'm for something for nothing. I'm going to give you something for nothing or very little.
Yeah.
And this guy here is imposing some burdens on you. You ought to vote for me. But if we change the rules of the game so they all have to be more honest,
sure,
then
that makes
we're going to get better policy.
Well, the other thing, too, is the larger we make and the more unaccountable we make the bureaucracy, the more these people just dig in. Like, we have a big dam here, Shasta Dam. It holds back 25 miles of water, so it's a big facility. It's a hydroelectric dam. They've talked about raising the level of the dam, and I didn't realize how long that had been going on. So I was at a meeting and Bureau of Reclamation, and this lady's talking about it. And I was like, how long have you guys been working on this anyway? And I'm thinking a few years. 34. 34 of years.
For sure.
I mean, there are people who've grown up, had children, and their kids are in college now.
Yeah, but the reason governments like that is because of these tricks. Because whenever there's a complaint, they just add a new layer. Because it doesn't cost them anything because they're not responsible for the consequences. So what we got to do is make them responsible for the consequences.
Yeah,
so,
somebody
for example,
needed
on
to
regulation,
decide. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, somebody needed to decide. Are we going to do this or not do it? If we're not doing it, let's stop talking about it and be done with it.
Yeah. So, for example, what I'd say is on any kind of major regulatory thing, Congress has to hold a roll call vote. Then we're going to know where they stand. So instead of one bunch of members of Congress saying, I'm against regulation killing children, and another bunch saying, one bunch saying, I'm against pollution killing children, and the other bunch saying, I'm against regulation killing jobs, they'll vote on the actual regulation, which will obviously involve some trade-offs between jobs and health protection. That's just inevitable. And then we can hold them accountable for the consequences.
Sure.
Now we just have more and more and more study and blah, 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 and we hate the result.
Yeah, because it's becoming, and I mean, I think you hit it early on, it's becoming untenable. We can't just pay for this bloated disaster going on forever and ever and ever.
Well, that's why only 19% of the public trust the government to do the right thing, which is, I think, the hope for change. When we have such widespread disgust with our federal government, there's a hope we could get something like My Honest Deal Act passed such that they once again be responsible for the consequences and we once again have a government that serves us.
Yeah, I'm totally catching that. When we come back, let's see, we need to talk about the war trick. That is,
sure.
That's on my list. That's trick number 5. We're here with our guest, David Schoenbrod. He has written a book called DC Confidential, Inside the 5 Tricks of Washington. So you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So
it feels like these days. Unless the government's controlling every minute of your life, they don't love you anymore.
And too much is not enough.
And too much is not enough. God, I've got to tell you, it's enough for me. So, David, what is the... because we covered, okay, the money trick. We did the federal mandate trick. We did regulation trick. What about the debt guarantee trick? Did we do that one?
No, we haven't done that one.
And the war trick.
Before the war trick.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect.
Okay. So the debt guarantee trick, this is where the government guarantees the debts of the big two big-to-fail banks.
Oh, the one everyone really loves.
Yeah. Now, you might say, well, don't give them any guarantees. The problem is there isn't hardly any politicians that if a bunch of these banks began to totter on the brink of bankruptcy, they'd be willing to let them go over because they'd be scared that there'd be a financial collapse that would sweep everything away. So push comes to shove, whether we agree or not, they're going to bail them out. They're going to pay the debts. So the question, the real question is this. Is the government going to do what any private business would do if asked to guarantee the debts of another company, which is to charge them a fee? And the fee ought to be higher the riskier the debts are that you're guaranteeing. So if a bank is doing a lot of speculative stuff, they'll pay a really high fee for their guarantee. And we could do that by using the market to evaluate what it would cost them in the private marketplace to guarantee a small part of their debt. If we did charge such fees to these banks, they couldn't engage in speculation without having to pay a really big fee. So that would give them a profit-based motive not to speculate. Now, what happened then is the government gave them the guarantees for free, which meant they saved a ton of money in terms of having to pay for the guarantees, and it let them borrow all kinds of money to use to speculate. And in good times, that, you know, the speculations turned out great, and they made a fortune. Bad times come along, and they go bust, then we got to bail them out, or we do bail them out, whether we had to or not, we did, and we would. So, and so the politicians who started these debt guarantees back in the 70s and 80s, they got all kinds of campaign contributions from the banks, because the banks loved it, obviously. But the blame for the bailouts came in 2007, when 2008, when we had to bail them out. So after all this, voters are really angry at Washington, but the people they should be voting, blaming, are the people who were in office 20 years earlier. So what does Congress do? It passes the Dodd-Frank Act, claiming there's going to be no more bailouts. It's a lie. The Dodd-Frank Act continues the bailouts. It still doesn't charge an adequate fee. So the debt guarantee continues. Debt guarantee trick continues, which means that we're going to have another financial crisis down the road. Meantime, the incumbents in Congress are going to continue to get big campaign contributions from the banks, but the blame for the bailouts are going to come decades from now or a while from now when the next financial crisis hits. We got to stop this.
No kidding.
There's an easy answer. Charge these firms a market-based fee for the debt guarantees. That'll ensure, better than any regulation would, that they're not going to get engaged in wild speculation.
Sure, because it would actually have a financial consequence rather than a free ride.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
We're incentivizing these banks to
act
wild.
Well, it's kind of funny because we don't do this with children or dogs. I mean, we all know. I mean, you know what I mean? The principles of raising children and raising dogs, and I'm probably other animals, but I know about dogs. We don't do that with either of them. You don't let them just run wild and then expect them to behave because that's silly. So why isn't it silly other places?
Exactly. Well, it's not just that. It's like letting children run wild and giving them sugar.
Well, there's that. Yeah, that's right. I had one of those sit in front of me in church a few weeks ago, and this lady was giving him all this processed food, red juice. I was like, you're killing me. He's running. He's got a transformer in a car running up and down the middle of the aisle. I'm thinking, really? She had everything but a net, which is so too bad because I really was wishing I had a net or a pygmy blow dart gun. But
Same, because it's so much more subtle than a net.
You have a confession for what you were thinking.
I know. I know, it's funny. I got nothing out of it. I was just trying to figure out how I could corral the kid without his mother seeing. But no, the same principles apply. And for some reason, it doesn't seem to factor in when we get to government, because that's a different reality. Like what?
Yeah. Well, but now we got a president who says he knows the art of the deal. Well, we're getting a pretty darn crummy deal from these banks. I hope somebody working for President Trump is listening and would have President Trump insist that we get a fair deal from these banks.
Bust out the net.
Yeah, exactly.
So if they repealed Dodd-Frank, what would that do for us?
Well, okay, Dodd-Frank does two things. One is it continues. Repealing Dodd-Frank isn't going to stop the debt guarantee trick. Actually, would mean, because these financial scholars tell me, whatever is on the statute books, if these companies go bust,
right,
they're going to get bailed out anyway. So all it would mean was they're getting their debt guarantees for free. Repealing it would be to get rid of the regulations under Dodd-Frank, and some of them are good, some of them aren't so good. But I'm not getting into that. I'm not calling for repealing Dodd-Frank. My Honest Deal Act would require to be done is to charge these too big to fail firms a fee, a market based fee,
right?
And then they wouldn't get no more welfare for Wall Street. That's what I'm saying.
Sure, and you probably wouldn't get a lot of people in the country that would be mad about that.
Oh, but the bankers would hate it.
Right, but I mean, regular voters would probably go, gosh,
oh, regular
that makes
voters
sense.
Should love it. Right. It would be money for the federal treasury that comes out of the bank, not out of them.
Right.
And the welfare for Wall Street.
Well, I don't think you'd get a lot of argument about that.
Good. At least two of us agree.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think?
I'm in.
Oh, Bob's in. We've got three.
Well, listen, I want you two, at least, to go to my website, which is
dc-confidential.org,
and under the tab Action there, in just a few minutes, you could write to your members of Congress and tell them you want an honest deal and ask them to pledge to support my Honest Deal Act.
And so the Honest Deal Act is at dc-confidential.org?
Right. There's a description of the act there. There's a tool that will let you quickly write your members of Congress, and there's some online games that show you very graphically how these tricks hurt you and me.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. Sorry, I didn't put that on the website.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like this before. Yeah,
I will add that to the website for today, so people can go there in case they're driving and thinking, "Well, that's great. I don't have a pen." That's okay. We've got you covered. All right, so we have to one more quick break, and then we're going to talk about the war trick.
Okay.
Because that's our fifth one. I can't believe it. We got it all in. We're really organized today. See, a lot of days, it's just like lots of catch up. Not today. Today we're on track. It's because Bill's not here. We're going to blame Bill. Bill goes under the bus.
Never miss an opportunity.
Exactly.
Never had a doubt.
Good song for a political topic. Our guest today is David Schoenbrod. He has written a book called DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington, and we have laid them out for you. We have the money trick, the debt guarantee trick, the federal mandate trick, the regulation trick, and now war, our favorite topic.
Okay, so this trick, David, like the others, began in the middle of the 20th century. For the first 160 years of our nation, the president couldn't go to war without getting Congress to approve, either by declaring war or by getting an explicit statute from Congress, you know, explicitly approving the war. But that changed in Korea, where Truman went into Korea in 1950 without getting congressional approval. He said, well, it was just a police action. 33,000 Americans died there. The public didn't like the idea of the president going to war without being clear with the country and getting approval of Congress. So Congress in 1973 passed something called the War Powers Act. And it basically said that before going to war, the president had to go to Congress and get a vote of approval. And if he didn't, if Congress voted it down, the war had to stop. So it turned out there was a loophole in the War Powers Act, and Congress and the president together collude, so Congress doesn't have to vote on controversial wars. So if the war turns out to be popular, the members of Congress get to vote, march in the victory parade. And if it turns out to be unpopular, they put all the blame on the president. And the president, for his part, her part, gets the ability to go to war without getting approval from Congress. And this is just, it's undemocratic, but it's also bad because we have getting to war, into wars where the country's divided.
Yeah.
And so we end up fighting with each other rather than fighting our enemies. So there's a very simple way of fixing the War Powers Act so it actually is binding on the president, which would then mean we would only go to war if we agree with each other. But Congress doesn't want it to be fixed because they don't want to be responsible.
Yeah, and that doesn't really make any sense at the end of the day because that takes the people out of the equation. The people's representatives are not voting on something that is going to affect all of them.
Exactly, which is exactly why the representatives don't want to do anything about it. But anyway, so there's an easy fix to every one of these tricks if we can get Congress to do it. And I think we can. And the reason I think we can is, first of all, a lot of us are disgusted. Like, you know, only 19% trust the government to do the right thing most of the time. The rest of us don't think so. We want to drain the swamp, as somebody did, either voting for Trump or Bernie Sanders. What's keeping the water in the swamp are the tricks. So we need to push them out. And there are things we have going in our favor besides the fact that many of us are disgusted. One of them is that a lot of officials actually are hurt by the war, by these tricks. Like the governors and the mayors are hurt by the federal mandate trick.
Sure.
And actually, when you think about it from the point of view of the representatives, they don't gain either. I mean, think about their life. You know, my impression is that many of them, even though we think of them as evil people or it's easy to demonize them, think about it from their point of view. Everybody else in Congress is playing tricks. So if I don't, I look like I'm a bad guy. I'm the messenger bearing the bad tidings. I'll get blamed. Or if my party stops the tricks, then the other party's going to do better at the election because the tricks are politically advantageous.
Sure.
So what I'm saying...
And you have 535 people, so of course, you know, everybody isn't everybody. And, you know, you always have different people doing different things. However, in a system that cumbersome, I mean, it's pretty hard to just launch out on your own and be the, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to fix with a handful of people.
So instead of hating the members of Congress for playing the tricks, we got to change the game, change the rules of the game, and that's what the Honest Deal Act is designed to do. And I think that if a number of us begin to tell our members of Congress, no, we don't want to be promised something for nothing, we want an honest deal, I think many of them are going to be responsive. And then also I think that the day is going to come when somebody's going to run for president on the basis that they want to stop the tricks. And I think that'd be a pretty effective platform for a presidential candidate. And so I think the more of us get behind this thing, the better chance we have of prevailing. And I got forwards for my book written by Howard Dean on the left and Mike Lee on the right. This is a platform that could sell across the political spectrum.
Sure.
So,
well, I think Trump
did. I would urge your listeners to go to my website and ask their members of Congress to take the Honest Deal pledge.
Yeah, and the other thing is too. I think that Donald Trump really kind of ran. I mean, I don't know if you read your book, but this has been a large part of his platform.
Well, he talked about the swamp, but you know, so far, only so far, because he's only been in for a while, he really hasn't done anything against any of the tricks. Now he might. I hope he does. I hope his people. I have people that are trying to talk to his people, but
your people are talking to his people.
So far, I don't know. The jury's out, but. He says he's, I mean, at this point, I don't know if he's going to be a swamp drainer or a swamp dweller.
Sure.
But the chances of his becoming a swamp drainer are going to be greater if people go in and start asking their people we elect to stop the tricks.
Sure. And, you know, the other thing, too, people need to get a little bit more plugged in on what's actually happening and maybe a little dose of reality that, I mean, I was at a town hall last week.
Yeah.
And there was a kid, 12 years old maybe, I'm just kind of guessing based on height, but, you know, he was an elementary school or early junior high kid. And the comment was made that, you know, Washington shouldn't be in charge of everything. That was one of the answers. The congressman said, I'm not in favor of the government being in charge of everything. And this kid was talking to his mom. He was quiet. I mean, he didn't yell out or anything, but he says, well, He doesn't really know what he's talking about, because that's why we have a government. They're supposed to tell us what to do.
Ah.
And I thought, oh my gosh. I mean, so that's kind of, we have a segment of our society that believes that and is teaching their children that. So they'll be growing up like looking for government to do everything. Super spooky.
I think what happened around the time the tricks began is our view of government would change. Our government used to be, we used to think of our government as a way that the people could take care of themselves. Now we think of government as this great father in the sky who's handing down sugar plums.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And if they talk about reforming anything, or they talk about, you know, maybe we need to figure out if this program can last forever. I mean, they put these things in place, but you got to pay for them, and you put the next thing in place, you got to pay for it. So as the budget becomes unsustainable, if you even mention that, you are, I mean, you know, literally people are like, if they take a look at Social Security, that's genocide. I'm like, wow. People who've actually died because of genocide probably roll over in their graves, but
yeah,
the citizens have to be okay with that too. Getting honest.
I agree.
I think that was fun, and that was a very fast hour.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. Are we off the air now?
No, we're still on here, but we're almost done. We got
well, then there's a chance to ask your readers, buy my book, please.
Yeah, and it's all on there. It is on, it's on your website at dc-confidential.org. And the rest of you, send the show. It'll be there commercial-free here in another hour or two at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest, David Schoenbrod, has been here gratefully for the full hour. Thanks a million.
I enjoy talking with you, Aaron.
Thanks very much. We hope to hear from you again. Let us know
okay,
your progress.
Thank you.
All right. Everybody have a great Sunday. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Aaron. This is KCNR Shasta Redding.